Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KALW's radio magazine for the performing arts. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. On this week's program, we continue with the third and final part of E.M. Forster's dystopian science fiction story, The Machine Stops, for our Corona Radio Theater segment, presented by actors from Word for Word. And I'll talk with one of the co-founders of Word for Word, Susan Harlow, once again, who also acts in the performance. Pioneering video artist John Sanborn shares his latest collaboration, an installment at SF Gallery 836M Gallery, with Paris-based composer and video artist Agnes Guillaume, who also joins us. And Peter Robinson muses on the recent passing of John le Carré and reviews the new Tom Hanks film, News of the World. Stay with us. You may have seen the work of my first guest without knowing the authorship. While I was never a big fan of MTV in its earliest days in the 1980s, I do remember the high-energy interstitial videos that so ingrained the MTV logo in my head. That's the work of John Sanborn. John was a key member of the so-called second wave of American video artists that included Bill Viola, Gary Hill, Dara Birnbaum, and Tony Ausler. He's collaborated with artists like Philip Glass and Grace Jones, and Van Halen, and his work has been shown at the Tate Modern, the Prado in Madrid, the Pompidou Center in Paris, the Whitney in New York, among many others. His collaboration with the San Francisco-based group The Residents, good friend of KALW Joshua Raoul Brody, music director, called God in Three Persons, had multiple live performance at MoMA in New York a year ago this month. It was critically lauded by The New Yorker, among other publications, an excerpt of which is at John's website, which you can find at our website. One of his latest projects is a collaboration at SF Gallery 836M Gallery at 836 Montgomery called All Roads Lead with Paris-based composer and video artist Agnes Guillaume. I should also mention that John's spouse is none other than my dear friend, extraordinary pianist and host of Revolutions Per Minute here on KALW, Sarah Cahill. John, a pleasure to finally talk with you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. It's great to have Sarah Cahill, the bold-faced name in the family, mentioned on air, but great to be here and great to be able to talk with Agnes in Paris about our show, All Roads Lead.
Indeed, Agnes is with us from Paris. It's 10 o'clock p.m. down there right now, over there, I should say. A former composer who then branched out to making video art, whose work has been shown at the Petit Palais, also known as the Fine Arts Museum of the City of Paris, and the Royal Museums of Fine Arts of Belgium, among other places. And for John and Agnes, it was artistic love at first sight, or as the French say, a coup de foudre, when they first saw each other's work in Paris at different galleries, but coincidentally on the same theme, Adam and Eve. Agnes, bienvenue à Open Air.
Merci beaucoup. Hello, good evening. Yes, it was really a coup de foudre with John. Actually, he came to my opening, and we just thought we had so much in common. And then he already knew that we sing the piece I had, which was Adam and Eve. And then he brought me to his gallery and I discovered he had an Adam and Eve too, which is quite not a coincidence. And since then, we start to be very close, not only friends, but too close with our work. Mm-hmm. Isn't true?
Mm-hmm. Yes. I think when we were invited by 836M, one of the reasons that we thought it would be a great idea was the way that while we are very, very different artists, our approach and our methods are very distinct and almost on opposite ends of a spectrum, the way that we connect is by theme and a lot by the empathy that we have expressed through the works that we create.
Well, John, you describe your work as being maximalist compared to Agnès as minimalist. How are those distinctions made manifest?
Agnès will imagine and then create a single image from which you will have multiple impressions. You'll see the surface, you'll go a little deeper, you'll go a little deeper, and then you'll come back to the surface. So the resonance of the way that her work operates is profound. And I'm just the opposite. I'll just throw a lot of stuff at you with the idea that you can manufacture a story in your head from the materials that I'm providing for you.
Agnès, is that what attracted you to John's work, that large-based kind of throw-it-all-at-you aspect as opposed to the quieter end of things?
Well, I was first very much impressed by his virtuosity. Is that an English word? Because he can do whatever he wants with images. He can do it. And he can just work them in any kind of forms. And that's very, very impressive, especially for me, which I am a young video artist, which, I mean, it's only 10 years that I do that. And my language is much more simple because, as John said it, I try to show complexity through very simple images. So, yes, I think that's the difference in between us was extremely attractive because, as John said, we are interested in the same topics. We share a lot about human being, what it is to be a human being today, and the way we approach it, it's so different that, of course, it's very interesting.
John, I guess the same question for you is you must have been attracted to Agnès's more minimal approach to things and seeing how you might be able to work together.
Indeed. What I identified with immediately was her great precision in art direction, tone, tempo. We're both working with multiple screens, and you'll see four works at 836M in San Francisco. And each of the four works are comprised of multiple screens. However, the first images that I saw of Agnès, I thought, oh, this is a trick, because I saw two figures. I saw the red drape of a theater, and I saw what looked like a beautiful Italian landscape going off to the distance. And then I realized, no, that this wasn't done in the studio. This was done on location, and all the choices were so precisely described. It blew me away. I, however, to get to the same place, would find ways to fuse and mash and remix images, again, with this supposition, like a musical composer, that you could hear the four instruments and you could put together the substance of the work in your mind.
Well, some of the nuts and bolts of your installations is what is also curious to me. Seeing on your website such a variety of monitors, sizes, and the way that they all coordinate with each other. Speaking as someone who finds it a challenge to hook up a DVD player to a monitor, I imagine there's a lot of technology that is involved in making these things happen. Is it customized software that you're using, or is it something that's readily available that just takes a lot of work and time?
The artist's relationship to technology is a curious and evolving situation. Agnès has a much more fine art oriented view of how to put together her
yes.
works.
Yeah, in this show, I have one piece with a neon title, by example. So it's not only video, not only screens, but a neon title. And The other piece, because we have each of us two pieces, and the other piece, it's technically quite new too, because it's on LED screens framed with plexiglass. So yes, technique has something to do with video, but as in any art form, technique is just a middle. It's not the important thing. Yeah. It's just a way to express. I would say it's like on cooking recipe, but it's not that much of the piece. Mm-hmm.
Well, please go.
The simile I would offer is when you look at the work of David Hockney, the first thing that strikes you is the palette, the line, the flow of the brush strokes. But that's used in service of whatever he's trying to tell you, whatever he's trying to describe. And I think the same thing is true in different ways for both Agnes and I. There are times where we want you to know that this is a technological display. Like Agnes's piece called Souls is a series of five LED screens, which would normally be a low resolution render of an image. However, she's put frosted plexiglass over it so that it has this kind of very ephemeral ghost-like appearance. And I have a piece that's 24 screens, 8 big ones and 16 smaller ones. So there's no escaping the rectangle. But after a while, you start to see the continuity that I've written into the work as you look from screen to screen to screen to screen.
Are you involved at all with the creation of those monitors, or do you just, spec them out and have them created for you? Because there are all these different sizes. It's not like just watching a television set.
Yeah, they are created especially. And as John said, the neon thing, the piece with the, not the neon is of course done for me, but the screens with LED, it's not only that they are made for me, but the process, I let's say, invented it. To show it framed with a plexiglass, I think nobody did it before, but it went perfectly well with this piece, so that's how I use it.
Let's talk a little bit about the title of the exhibition, All Roads Lead. Now, is it up to the visitor to decide the where to?
One of the very charming Fred and Ginger kind of duets that we have been involved in the almost 3 years that we've known each other is a push and pull between the obvious and the mysterious. Mm. Each of us has ways to create layers of mystery, to leave questions unanswered, or to provoke people to look deeper. And Agnes is often telling me that, oh no, don't do that. That's too obvious. That's too on the nose. So when we had ideas for titles, I wanted the title of the show somehow to relate to the fact that we are friends and that our work is very conversational, that we're talking to each other through artistic means. Mm. And so yep. she came back with this, with the idea that all roads lead to us, but each of us took our own path to get there.
Interesting. Yeah. Uh-huh. And you did mention this choreography among the monitors, and Agnes has mentioned in her writing that she believes that video art is about movement, and it's as balletic as the Ballet Russe. It's amazing the way that you guys can do this just through working at a keyboard for the most part. And I encourage people to take a look. You've got a great opportunity to catch All Roads Lead at the Gallery 836M, because it's running through May. Encourage you go to 836M.org for more information. We'll have links to each of your websites as well as the gallery at our open air page for today. Agnes, John, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you,
David. A pleasure.
And John, yeah. I should mention that at John's website, you can also see her his collaboration with Sarah Cahill for the 2013 release of A Sweeter Music and the splendid videos that accompany Sarah's always virtuosic piano playing. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you, David.
Sure. Well, we've got time for a couple of moments with Susan Harlow next for our Word for Word segment as part of Corona Radio Theater. It's our third and final installment of The Machine Stops. Susan, welcome back.
Thank you. Thanks also so much, David.
Sure. Also acting in this position as a recap. In this production. As a recap, it's a dystopian science fiction story of E.M. Forster that dates from 1909, but is enormously prescient as to our current state of affairs. It was written between A Room with a View from 1908 and Howard's End, 1910. And after being voted one of the best novellas up to 1965, it was included in that same year in the populist anthology Modern Short Stories in 1973, also included in the Science Fiction Hall of Fame, Volume 2. So a great choice.
Thank you.
Where are we heading in Part 3? It's subtitled The Homeless.
Yes. Well, so interesting that they use the word homeless. Homelessness means death in this society. I don't want to give it away, but it's something that Vashti and her son Kuno are going to go through that's going to take us to the end and into the future in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I think I was reading more on Forster's works, and he wrote a 1951 collection called Two Cheers for Democracy. Maybe that would be a great subject for another word-for-word collaboration.
I'm writing it down.
Let's hear The Machine Stops now here as part of the Corona Radio Theater, a work by E.M. Forster. Thanks for being with us, Susan. Oh, you wanted to mention some other things happening at Z-Space.
I wanted to say that we are inspired by our experience with KALW back this summer and spring. We are continuing to create actual podcasts that you can find on our website. They're free to the public. You can always donate. And our website is www.zspace.org/pod.
P-O-D. All right. Thank you so much, Susan. And let's raise the curtain on the Corona Radio Theater.
The Machine Stops by E.M. Forster.
3. The Homeless.
During the years that followed Kuno's escapade, two important developments took place in the machine. On the surface, they were revolutionary, but in either case, men's minds had been prepared beforehand, and they did but express tendencies that were latent already. The first of these was the abolition of respirators.
Advanced thinkers, like Vashti, had always held it foolish to visit the surface of the Earth. Airships might be necessary, but what was the good of going out for mere curiosity and crawling along for a mile or two in a terrestrial motor? The habit was vulgar, and perhaps faintly improper. It was unproductive of ideas, and had no connection with the habits that really mattered.
So respirators were abolished, and with them, of course, the terrestrial motors. And except for a few lecturers...
who complained that they were debarred access to their subject matter.
The development was accepted quietly.
Those who still wanted to know what the Earth was like had, after all, only to listen to some gramophone or to look into some somatophote.
And even the lecturers acquiesced when they found that a lecture on the sea was nonetheless stimulating when compiled out of other lectures that had already been delivered on the same subject. Beware of first-hand ideas, exclaimed one of the most advanced of them. First-hand ideas do not really exist. They are but the physical impressions produced by love and fear. And on this gross foundation, who could erect a philosophy? Let your ideas be second-hand, and if possible, tenth-hand, for then they will be far removed from that disturbing element, direct observation. Do not learn anything about this subject of mine, the French Revolution. Learn instead what I think that Enikomon thought, Urizen thought, Gutch thought, Ho-Young thought, Chirbo Singh thought, Lafcadio Hearn thought, Carlyle thought, Mirabeau said about the French Revolution. Through the medium of these 10 great minds, the blood that was shed at Paris and the windows that were broken at Versailles will be clarified to an idea which you may employ most profitably in your daily lives. But be sure that the intermediates are many and varied, for in history one authority exists to counteract another. Urizen must counteract the skepticism of Ho-Young and Enikomon. I must myself counteract the impetuosity of Gutch. You who listen to me are in a better position to judge about the French Revolution than I am. Your descendants will be even in a better position than you, for they will learn what you think I think, and yet another intermediate will be added to the chain. And in time...
His voice rose.
There will come a generation that had got beyond facts, beyond impressions, a generation absolutely colorless, a generation seraphically free from taint of personality, which will see the French Revolution not as it happened, nor as they would like it to have happened, but as it would have happened had it taken place in the days of the machine.
Tremendous applause greeted this lecture, which did but voice a feeling already latent in the minds of men.
A feeling that terrestrial facts must be ignored, and that the abolition of respirators was a positive gain. It was even suggested that airships should be abolished too.
This was not done, because airships had somehow worked themselves into the machine system.
But year by year, they were used less, and mentioned less by thoughtful men.
The second great development was the reestablishment of religion. This too had been voiced in the celebrated lecture. No one could mistake the reverent tone in which the peroration had concluded, and it awakened a responsive echo in the heart of each.
Those who had long worshipped silently now began to talk.
They described the strange feeling of peace that came over them when they handled the Book of the Machine. The pleasure it was to repeat certain numerals out of it, however little meaning those numerals conveyed to the outward ear. The ecstasy of touching a button, however unimportant, or of ringing an electric bell, however superfluously.
The machine, they exclaimed, feeds us and clothes us and houses us. Through it we speak to one another. Through it we see one another. In it we have our being. The machine is the friend of ideas and the enemy of superstition. The machine is omnipotent, eternal. Blessed is the machine.
And before long, this allocution was printed on the first page of the book. And in subsequent editions, the ritual swelled into a complicated system of praise and prayer.
The word religion was sedulously avoided, and in theory, the machine was still the creation and implement of man.
But in practice, all save a few retrogrades worshipped it as divine. Nor was it worshipped in unity.
One believer would be chiefly impressed by the blue optic plates,
through which he saw other believers.
Another by the mending apparatus, which sinful Kuno had compared to worms. Another by the lips. Another by the book. And each would pray to this or to that, and ask it to intercede for him with the machine as a whole.
Persecution, that also was present. It did not break out for reasons that will be set forward shortly, but it was latent, and all who did not accept the minimum known as
undenominational mechanism
lived in danger of homelessness, which means death, as we know.
To attribute these two great developments to the Central Committee is to take a very narrow view of civilization. The Central Committee announced the developments, it is true, but they were no more the cause of them than were the kings of the imperialistic period the cause of war.
Rather did they yield to some invincible pressure which came no one knew whither, and which, when gratified, was succeeded by some new pressure equally invincible. To such a state of affairs, it is convenient to give the name of progress.
No one confessed the machine was out of hand.
Year by year, it was served with increased efficiency and decreased intelligence. The better a man knew his own duties upon it, the less he understood the duties of his neighbor. And in all the world, there was not one who understood the monster as a whole. Those master brains had perished. They had left full directions, it is true, and their successors had each of them mastered a portion of those directions. But humanity, in its desire for comfort, had overreached itself. It had exploited the riches of nature too far. Quietly and complacently, it was sinking into decadence, and progress had come to mean the progress of the machine. As for Vashti, her life went peacefully forward until the final disaster.
She made her room dark and slept. She awoke and made the room light. She lectured and attended lectures. She exchanged ideas with her innumerable friends and believed she was growing more spiritual. At times, a friend was granted euthanasia and left his or her room for the homelessness that is beyond all human conception. Vashti did not much mind. After an unsuccessful lecture, she would sometimes ask for euthanasia herself. But the death rate was not permitted to exceed the birth rate.
And the machine had hitherto refused it to her.
The troubles began quietly, long before she was conscious of them. One day she was astonished at receiving a message from her son. They never communicated, having nothing in common, and she had only heard indirectly that he was still alive and had been transferred from the northern hemisphere, where he had behaved so mischievously, to the southern, indeed to a room not far from her own.
Does he want me to visit him, she thought? Never again, never. And I have not the time.
No, it was madness of another kind.
He refused to visualize his face upon the blue plate, and speaking out of the darkness with solemnity, said,
"The machine stops."
What do you say?
The machine is stopping. I know it. I know the signs.
She burst into a peal of laughter.
He heard her and was angry, and they spoke no more.
"Can you imagine anything more absurd?" she cried to a friend. "A man who was my son believes that the machine is stopping. It would be impious if it were not mad."
"The machine is stopping," her friend replied. "What does that mean? The phrase conveys nothing to me."
"Nor to me."
"He does not refer, I suppose, to the trouble there has been lately with the music?"
"Oh, no, of course not. Let's talk about music."
"Have you complained to the authorities?"
"Yes, and they say it wants mending and referred me to the committee of the mending apparatus. I complained of those curious gasping sighs that disfigure the symphonies of the Brisbane School. They sound like someone in pain. The committee of the mending apparatus say that it shall be remedied shortly." Obscurely worried, she resumed her life. For one thing, the defect in the music irritated her. For another thing, she could not forget Kuno's speech. If he had known that the music was out of repair, he could not know it, for he detested music. If he had known that it was wrong,
"The machine stops,"
was exactly the venomous sort of remark he would have made. Of course, he had made it at a venture, but the coincidence annoyed her. And she spoke with some petulance to the committee of the mending apparatus.
They replied, as before, that the defect would be set right shortly.
"Shortly? At once," she retorted. "Why should I be worried by imperfect music? Things are always put right at once. If you do not mend it at once, I shall complain to the Central Committee."
"No personal complaints are received by the Central Committee," the committee of the mending apparatus replied.
"Through whom am I to make my complaint, then?"
"Through us."
"I complain, then."
"Your complaint shall be forwarded in its turn."
"Have others complained?"
This question was unmechanical, and the committee of the mending apparatus refused to answer it.
"It is too bad," she exclaimed to another of her friends. There never was such an unfortunate woman as myself. I can never be sure of my music now. It gets worse and worse each time I summon it.
I too have my troubles, the friend replied. Sometimes my ideas are interrupted by a slight jarring noise.
What is it?
I do not know whether it is inside my head or inside the wall.
Complain, in either case.
I have complained, and my complaint will be forwarded in its turn to the Central Committee.
Time passed, and they resented the defects no longer. The defects had been remedied, but the human tissues in that latter day had become so subservient that they readily adapted themselves to every caprice of the machine. The sigh at the crises of the Brisbane Symphony no longer irritated Vashti.
She accepted it as part of the melody.
The jarring noise, whether in the head or in the wall, was no longer resented by her friend.
And so with the moldy artificial fruit. So with the bathwater that began to stink. So with the defective rhymes that the poetry machine had taken to emit. All were bitterly complained of at first, and then acquiesced in and forgotten. Things went from bad to worse, unchallenged. It was otherwise with the failure of the sleeping apparatus. That was a more serious stoppage. There came a day when over the whole world, in Sumatra, in Wessex, in the innumerable cities of Courland and Brazil, the beds, when summoned by their tired owners, failed to appear. It may seem a ludicrous matter, but from it we may date the collapse of humanity.
The committee responsible for the failure was assailed by complainants, whom it referred, as usual, to the Committee of the Mending Apparatus.
Who in its turn assured them that their complaints would be forwarded to the Central Committee.
But the discontent grew, for mankind was not yet sufficiently adaptable to do without sleeping.
Someone is meddling with the machine, they began.
Someone is trying to make himself king. To reintroduce the personal element.
Punish that man with homelessness.
To the rescue! Avenge the machine! Avenge the machine!
War! Kill the man!
War!
Kill the man!
War!
War!
But the committee of the mending apparatus now came forward and allayed the panic with well-chosen words. It confessed that the mending apparatus was itself in need of repair.
The effect of this frank confession was admirable.
Of course,
said a famous lecturer, he of the French Revolution, who gilded each new decay with splendor.
Of course we shall not press our complaints now. The mending apparatus has treated us so well in the past that we all sympathize with it and will wait patiently for its recovery. In its own good time, it will resume its duties. Meanwhile, let us do without our beds, our tabloids, our other little wants. Such, I feel sure, would be the wish of the machine.
Thousands of miles away, his audience applauded.
The machine still linked them. Under the seas, beneath the roots of the mountains, ran the wires through which they saw and heard, the enormous eyes and ears that were their heritage, and the hum of many workings clothed their thoughts in one garment of subserviency.
Only the old and the sick remained ungrateful, for it was rumored that euthanasia, too, was out of order, and that pain had reappeared among men.
It became difficult to read. A blight entered the atmosphere and dulled its luminosity. At times, Vashti could scarcely see across her room. The air, too, was foul. Loud were the complaints, impotent the remedies, heroic the tone of the lecturer as he cried,
Courage! Courage! What matter so long as the machine goes on? To it, the darkness and the light are one.
And though things improved again after a time, the old brilliancy was never recaptured, and humanity never recovered from its entrance into twilight. There was hysterical talk.
Of measures.
Of provisional dictatorship.
And the inhabitants of Sumatra were asked
to familiarize themselves with the workings of the central power station.
The said power station being situated in France.
but for the most part panic reigned, and men spent their strength praying to their books, tangible proofs of the machine's omnipotence.
There were gradations of terror.
At times came rumors of hope.
The mending apparatus was almost mended.
The enemies of the machine had been got under.
New nerve centers were evolving, which would do the work even more magnificently than before.
But there came a day when, without the slightest warning, without any previous hint of feebleness, the entire communication system broke down all over the world. And the world, as they understood it, ended.
Vashti was lecturing at the time, and her earlier remarks had been punctuated with applause. As she proceeded, the audience became silent. And at the conclusion, there was no sound. Somewhat displeased, she called to a friend who was a specialist in sympathy. No sound. Doubtless the friend was sleeping. And so with the next friend, whom she tried to summon, and so with the next, until she remembered Kuno's cryptic remark.
The machine stops.
The phrase still conveyed nothing. If eternity was stopping, it would of course be set going shortly. For example, there was still a little light and air. The atmosphere had improved a few hours previously. There was still the book. And while there was the book, there was security.
Then she broke down. For with the cessation of activity came an unexpected terror.
Silence. She had never known silence. And the coming of it nearly killed her.
It did kill many thousands of people outright.
Ever since her birth, she had been surrounded by the steady hum. It was to the ear what artificial air was to the lungs. An agonizing pain shot across her head. And scarcely knowing what she did, she stumbled forward and pressed the unfamiliar button, the one that opened the door of her cell.
Now the door of the cell worked on a simple hinge of its own. It was not connected with a central power station, dying far away in France. It opened, rousing immoderate hopes in Vashti.
For she thought that the machine had been mended. It opened, and she saw the dim tunnel that curved far away toward freedom. One look and she shrank back, for the tunnel was full of people. She was almost the last of the city to have taken alarm. People at any time repelled her, and these were nightmares from her worst dreams.
People were crawling about.
People were screaming!
Whimpering!
Gasping for breath!
Touching each other!
Vanishing in the dark!
And ever and anon being pushed off the platform onto the live rail.
Some were fighting around the electric bells, trying to summon trains which could not be summoned.
Others were yelling for euthanasia.
Or respirators.
Or blaspheming the machine.
Others stood at the doors of their cells, fearing, like herself, either to stop in them or to leave them. And behind all the uproar was silence.
The silence which is the voice of the earth and of the generations who have gone.
No, it was worse than solitude. She closed the door again and sat down to wait for the end. This disintegration went on, accompanied by horrible cracks and rumbling. The valves that restrained the medical apparatus must have weakened, for it ruptured and hung hideously from the ceiling. The floor heaved and fell and flung her from the chair. A tube oozed toward her, serpent fashion.
And at last, the final horror approached. Light began to ebb, and she knew civilization's long day was closing.
She whirled around, praying to be saved from this, at any rate, kissing the book, pressing button after button. The uproar outside was increasing and even penetrated the wall. Slowly, the brilliancy of her cell was dimmed. The reflections faded from the metal switches. Now she could not see the reading stand. Now not the book, though she held it in her hand.
Light followed the flight of sound. Air was following light. And the original void returned to the cavern from which it has so long been excluded.
Vashti continued to whirl like the devotees of an earlier religion, screaming, praying,
striking at the buttons with bleeding hands.
It was thus that she opened her prison and escaped. Escaped in the spirit, at least so it seems to me, ere my meditation closes. That she escapes in the body, I cannot perceive that.
She struck, by chance, the switch that released the door, and the rush of foul air on her skin, the loud throbbing whispers in her ears, told her that she was facing the tunnel again, and that tremendous platform on which she had seen men fighting. They were not fighting now. Only the whispers remained, and the little whimpering groans. They were dying by hundreds out in the dark. She burst into tears.
Tears answered her.
They wept for humanity, those two. Not for themselves. They could not bear that this should be the end. Ere silence was completed, their hearts were opened, and they knew what had been important on the earth. Man, the flower of all flesh, the noblest of all creatures visible, man who had once made God in his image and had mirrored his strength on the constellations. Beautiful, naked man was dying, strangled in the garments that he had woven. Century after century had he toiled, and here was his reward.
Truly, the garment had seemed heavenly at first, shot with colors of culture.
Sewn with the threads of self-denial.
And heavenly it had been so long as it was a garment and no more. Man could shed it at will and live by the essence that is his soul, and the essence equally divine that is his body. The sin against the body, it was for that they wept in chief. The centuries of wrong against the muscles and the nerves, and those five portals by which we can alone apprehend, glozing it over with talk of evolution, until the body was white pap, the home of ideas as colorless, last sloshy stirrings of a spirit that had grasped the stars.
"Where are you?" she sobbed.
His voice in the darkness said, "Here."
"Is there any hope, Kuno?"
"None for us."
"Where are you?" She crawled over the bodies of the dead. His blood spurted over her hands.
"Quicker," he gasped. "I am dying. But we touch. We talk not through the machine." He kissed her. "We have come back to our own. We die, but we have recaptured life as it was in Wessex when Alfred overthrew the Danes. We know what they know outside, they who dwelt in the cloud that is the color of a pearl."
"But Kuno, is it true? Are there still men on the surface of the earth? Is this tunnel, this poison darkness, really not the end?"
He replied, "I have seen them, spoken to them, loved them. They are hiding in the mist and the ferns until our civilization stops. Today, they are the homeless. Tomorrow..."
"Tomorrow. Some fool will start the machine again tomorrow."
"Never," said Kuno. "Never. Humanity has learned its lesson."
As he spoke, the whole city was broken like a honeycomb. An airship had sailed in through the vomitory into a ruined wharf. It crashed downwards, exploding as it went, rending gallery after gallery with its wings of steel. For a moment, he saw the nations of the dead and, before they joined them, scraps of the untainted sky.
Listening to The Machine Stops by E.M. Forster, first published in the Oxford and Cambridge Review in November of 1909. This broadcast and podcast was directed by Gendel Hing Hernandez, with an original sound design by David R. Molina, and was performed by Carla Gallardo, Susan Harlow, David Everett Moore, Brian Rivera, and Ryan Tasker. Delia McDougall was dramaturge, with sound engineering by Joe Moore, production manager Colm McNally. Presented as part of our Corona Radio Theater on Open Air and available as a podcast at zspace.org, where you can learn more about what's happening with Word for Word. Next week for our Corona Radio Theater segment, we'll welcome back artists from The Marsh. Julia McNeil and Charles Shaw Robinson perform an excerpt of Lynn Kaufman's Divine Madness live, which will be part of the Marsh Stream January 30th and 31st presentation. And if you're a fan of radio drama, don't forget that KALW broadcasts LA Theater Works on Friday evenings at 8. This week, The Divine Sister, written by and starring Charles Bush. I'm David LaTulipe, your host for Open Air. Pleased to be working with Neil Swinkles on our Corona Radio Theater segment and all the guests you hear. If you've got a suggestion for a guest, by all means, send me an email, david@kalw.org. Next up, Peter Robinson with a recollection of John le Carré and a movie review. Happy new era to you, Peter. I guess we're entering an era of civilization once again.
Yeah, here we go, David. It is civilized. Good to see you. Good to hear Ian Foster's work coming through loud and clear. And I've been reflecting over the last couple of weeks about the sad departure and death of the great British novelist John le Carré. I think he will go down as one of the major 20th century writers because he bridged the gap, he also moves into the 21st century. For people who may remember him best, it is for his character of George Smiley, and I'll come to him in a minute. But first, a couple of quick observations about how John le Carré came to write his books. He was working live in the flesh at British Intelligence, and he's one of the few, I think maybe only writers, who has worked for both MI5 and MI6. And to make the distinction, MI5 is domestic surveillance intelligence, MI6 is overseas, a similar breakup between the FBI and the CIA. Now, there have been other earlier writers who belong to the intelligence. Somerset Maugham would be a good example, and perhaps more famously, Graham Greene. Graham Greene only worked for one of the intelligence sources, MI6, and he was both a major influence on John le Carré, also a good friend to John le Carré. So before I move to his great novel, which is The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, let me talk about two of his early works, Call for the Dead, which came out in 1961. And this was written as his early morning commute took him into spy headquarters in London. So maybe one of the greatest mystery stories, and it is a detective story rather than a novel, written on a train going to his place of work. With The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, a couple of strange coincidences surround the publication of this story. 1963, it is, in fact, the same year that Kim Philby, one of the Cambridge spies, defected to Russia. In that year, he hopped on a boat from Beirut to Odessa, and the rest of his story is the story of the Great Betrayal. And the Great Betrayal is indeed at the background to so many of John le Carré's stories. It's a betrayal that involves the breakage of trust, the whole area of moral ambiguity, when do you sell your country out in favor of something else? And above all, how do you get along and live with it with the rest of your companions? One thing I want to say about le Carré as a writer, and that is he was a great voice reader. The way he told his stories was just beautiful pacing, timing, and he could do many different accents, from Russian accents to German accents. And then when it came to a British, he had everything from Cockney to upper class. So I thought we might hear a brief section of Le Carré reading his own words to give you a sense of that person that we lost last year. And Damien, if we could bring in just a touch of Le Carré reading from Agent Running.
Well, Steph, a lot of people will do a lot of things for money, and a lot of people will do things for spite or ego. There are also people who do things for an ideal, wouldn't take your money if you shoved it down their throats. And what ideal would that be exactly, Dad, from behind the shiny goggles? Well, let's say, for instance, somebody has an idealistic vision of England as the mother of all democracies. Or they love our dear Queen with an unexplained fervour. It may not be an England that exists for us anymore, if it ever did. But they think it does, so go with it. Do you think it does? With reservations? Serious reservations? Well, who wouldn't have, for Christ's sake? I replied, stung by the suggestion I somehow failed to notice that the country's in free fall. A minority Tory cabinet of 10th-raters, a pig-ignorant foreign secretary who I'm supposed to be serving, Labour no better, the sheer bloody lunacy of Brexit. I break off. I have feelings too. Let my indignant silence say the rest.
Okay, thank you, Damien. That indeed is the great voice of John Le Carré. And I think when you listen to him read a book, he has that sense of timing, that sense of storytelling, that sense of creating character, and above all, a sense of warmth in his voice. And of course, his key character, George Smiley, is indeed the antithesis of James Bond, Ian Fleming's famous hero. He describes Smiley in his first book as short, fat, quiet, unattractive, with really bad clothes, looking like a bullfrog in a sou'wester. And of course, he's married to the beautiful Lady Anne, who of course is constantly betraying him with different lovers. So if there's a kind of seedy world that comes out of his books, it's also a world that you find is believable. And when it comes to the English language, if you check out a dictionary, he has contributed many interesting words, such as mole, which is a deep penetration agent. He has the word circus. They all work at Cambridge Circus, which is a pun on the word Cambridge. And it is actually a tube stop after Oxford Circus. And then there are other words like honey trap, which is a spy word for seducing an agent to get to find out more about the country that he hopes will be betrayed. So we look at Le Carré then as a great storyteller, but also as a record of the Cold War. His books, and there were over 28 of them, have been translated into over 12 languages. He was popular in Russia, particularly popular with the London ambassador from Russia during the time of Boris Yeltsin. His famous series, Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy, and then The Perfect Spy, at different points were turned into movies. And who better than Alec Guinness to play that role of old-time Smiley, a man that you could convey every truth to, even when you didn't realise you were being interrogated. And some people thought that by the pull-down of the Berlin Wall, Le Carré would be finished. But oh no, he moves on. Stories about the drug trail. He goes to South Africa, he goes to North Africa. He gives us The Constant Gardener about the pharmaceutical industry. And then he gives us The Russian House. So here we are cataloguing exactly how things went on the outside, while at the same time remembering these are fiction, real works of fiction. If I want to quote one sentence, this would be it. It takes a lot of balance to ride two horses at the same time in the circus. Two horses at the same time in the circus. And it's a pun on the word circus, the open circus. It's a pun on the Cambridge Circus. John Le Carré will be a sad loss to us. He's like an old friend. As you go through his books, suddenly you're moved from the world outside you to the world inside your head. And that, to me, is based on his creation of character. goodbye, John, you've gone. And his name, John le Carré? No, it was never John le Carré, it was David Cornwall. But to write under his own name, the Secret Service said, you've got to have a nom de plume. And that's how we know him today, John le Carré. Now, in a totally different vein, I'm going to quickly finish with a new movie called News of the World. It's the first Western that Tom Hanks has appeared in. And I think it's a well-told story about Texas in 1876. And it's a journey through an occupation that today doesn't exist. The character is a news reader. He goes through all the newspapers, reads them in each town, gives the story a whole hum and buzz, and gets paid a dime for reading them. But on the way through, he hooks up with a young German girl, beautifully played by Helen Zenker, and it is the story really of a relationship. There is one gunfight in it, well done, and I think that gives it the clue to being a Western. But it's a moving story, a deep relationship between an aging captain from the Confederate forces restoring the meaning of how to be kind to people, how to be kind to people in the Western sense. And if there's one actor that can pull that off, it is, of course, who else better than Captain Jefferson Kidd? And in this case, Captain Jefferson Kidd is our old friend. And in that sense, we get taken into the sentiment, but it's not sentimental. I think it's a nice balancing act, certainly a Western that looks beyond simply the landscape and the gunfights and the carrying of guns. It's a Western about understanding. So the title again is called News of the World. It stars Tom Hanks as the indeed lovable Captain Jefferson Kidd, a Civil War veteran rediscovering Texas in 1876. And it's available on Netflix. You may have to pay for the first week because it's only just been released, but I think it's worth 2 hours of your time. So with that, I've got to say in my own heart, a sad goodbye to John le Carré and a new type of Western, News of the World, starring Hanks playing Captain Jefferson Kidd.
Thank you, Peter Robinson. And ironic that this is Tom Hanks' first Western, as he's very well known as voicing the Woody child's toy in Toy Story. So we have him live as in a Western rather than just his voice as voicing Woody. News of the World on Netflix. I'm going to look forward to that one, that's for sure.
Good to see you, David.
You too, Peter. Next week on Open Air, we'll be once again welcoming artists back from the Marsh to the virtual stage of our Corona Radio Theater. Julia McNeil and Charles Shaw Robinson perform an excerpt of Lynn Kaufman's Divine Madness. I'll also talk with Oakland-based soprano and fitness trainer Candace Y. Johnson, who offers a truly out-of-the-ordinary virtual class for all levels that combines physical activity with vocal training in her program, CJ's Fitness Sing. It's offered for free on Fridays at 12:30 and via the Marsh stream. The class is taught by Candace, and is a UC vocal professor. Join us then. I'll also help talk with pianist Jeffrey Kahan about a tribute concert for Robin Sutherland, the wonderful principal pianist of the San Francisco Symphony for 45 years, who passed away recently. Some remembrances and some musical excerpts of Robin Sutherland. I'm David Lotsfield. Thanks so much to Neil Swinkles for producing the show and for Damian D. Minor for engineering in the studios of KALW. Our shows are archived at kalw.org. And if you've got a show segment suggestion, please send me an email or a comment about today's show. David@kalw.org. Happy New Year, people. It's a new day. The sun is shining in so many ways. Thanks for being with us here on Open Air.